The Politics of an American Camelot, Reshaping the Future of Our Public Health. From STPB, today is Wednesday, October 22nd. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, PBS Frontline explores the rise of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. We'll look at how early political violence shaped his idea of conspiracy and how his road to public redemption left him searching for the cause that could cement his legacy. That's coming up after the news. Then our Dakota political junkies take the temperature of public rhetoric. Tom Dempster and Jonathan Ellis are with us. Plus, when are religious services behind bars constitutionally protected? When are they rehabilitative? We welcome Pastor Jeff Backer later in the hour. We're broadcasting today from STPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're In the Moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. The newest documentary from PBS Frontline covers the political journey of one of the most controversial figures in current events today. The rise of RFK Jr. dives into the life and ideas of the current Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services. It charts Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s rift with his family and the Democratic Party and how he became a top figure in the anti-vaccine movement. I spoke with writer and producer Mike Weiser. He has kind of a wild, free-for-all, deeply entitled childhood with lots of money and lots of animals and children everywhere. Tell me a little bit about how he grew up before his father was assassinated in an act of political violence.
Yeah, it's a good place to start because it's really hard to understand him if you don't understand the environment that he grew up in as a Kennedy, with his uncle in the White House, his dad, a prominent member of the cabinet after JFK, after his uncle's assassination. His father really steps forward and runs for president himself. And so he's on one hand surrounded by politics from a very early age, and he's also surrounded by privilege. He grows up on an estate called Hickory Hill, which, as you say, is sort of wild. It's got lots of animals and lots of kids running around, and it's a place where to anyone else it would seem strange. But for somebody like Robert F. Kennedy Jr., it was what he knew growing up. And he talks about what it was like to grow up in a place of great privilege and access to power from a very early age.
His father is assassinated when he's just 14 years old. This is a deep trauma on him that shows up in his behavior relatively quickly. What can you tell us about how the death of his father and his uncle before him really impacted and changed, perhaps, his trajectory?
It really was a tough moment for him. He's one of 11 kids. His mom, who's pregnant at the time, is struggling to take care of the family in the wake of this tragedy. And only a few months after his dad is killed, he's sent off to boarding school and sort of left to deal with things on his own. We spoke to his cousin, who said it wasn't something that they talked a lot about in the family, and that he thought that there was a lot of trauma, not just among the kids, but also among the adults. And he quickly found himself in trouble with withdrawing at school and in very public sort of drug scandals as a teenager. There was a lot of tension with his mom in the wake of that tragedy.
Many people from South Dakota remember or have heard of the time that he was arrested in South Dakota in Rapid City. He had heroin in his luggage, and this is a real turning point for him as well. Tell us a little bit. Now he's through Harvard. He can't pass the bar exam. He's really struggling, and now there's this very public humiliation and legal trouble that he's in. What starts his path to redemption, for lack of a better word?
It really is a crux moment in his life when he overdoses in the back of an airplane. He's arrested on heroin charges. And up until that point, as you said, he was at Harvard, somebody who was using pretty heavy and serious drugs. During that period of his life, he was able to graduate from Harvard. He was able to write a book. People told us he was really good at compartmentalizing his life. He was seemed to be functioning on one hand, but he was also descending into drug use on the other. And with that moment, where it's exposed, where he overdoses, where he's arrested, is when those two parts of his life come together. And the way he's talked about it, and written about it, is that that was a moment when he couldn't hide that part of himself anymore, and it would change his trajectory. It would send, as part of the community service that he had to do after the arrest, he got involved in environmental work, which would bring him to the Hudson Valley, and for over a decade he would work as an environmental activist, an environmental lawyer.
And this is where he gets introduced to this idea of mercury in the water and corporations poisoning the water and therefore putting children at risk. How does his work prosecuting polluters, as he's fond of saying, turn into a seed that will grow into concerns about what's in our vaccines? Where are the parallels between that? Because he doesn't stay as an environmental advocate. That's not how we know him today.
That's right. In those years as an environmental activist, as an environmental lawyer, he saw himself sort of fighting against big corporations that were polluting the environment, that were poisoning kids. He saw himself as somebody who was standing up, I think, in the tradition of his dad and his uncle, as somebody who was able to take on powerful forces. It also, as you said, brings him into this issue of mercury in rivers. And we talked to some of the people who had been involved in the issue of vaccines and claiming a link between a mercury and vaccines and autism, and a very controversial claim that a lot of scientists would say was not true. But they saw in him somebody who could be an advocate for him. And a group of moms and dads sought him out as he was talking around the country about mercury in the water, and said, "You need to pay attention to this issue of mercury in vaccines." And it was something that that he did embrace, a very controversial move on his part for somebody so prominent to get involved in such a controversial issue.
In fact, many people in your film say that perhaps the only reason that issue ended up in the public eye so much was because of his political celebrity, because he was the one who took up the cause and he was so well connected with publishing and Hollywood and Washington. How did he take this cause to now all the way to Washington, D.C.?
That's right. I mean, people told us that throughout his life, whether it was in the environmental activism, whether it was in the vaccine activism, whether it was his decision to run for president, that his name was a big part of it. That being a Kennedy, and not just any Kennedy, but being Robert F. Kennedy's son, was something that immediately gave him a kind of access. And it also gave him an access to the media, to power, to money, that other people wouldn't have had. And it was something that he knew his whole life. And so, the same way that he used that celebrity for the environmental cause, he also used it on the vaccine issue to be able to publish an article in Rolling Stone magazine and online at Salon, to do press interviews and other ways to draw attention to the issue that it might not have had if it wasn't for him and for his name.
Yeah, that Salon article is retracted years later. The science is debunked. He is silenced, he would argue, because of the mistakes that he made in his reporting. As you did this work, what did you notice, or what did people tell you about how RFK Jr. behaves when he's challenged? What does he think about people saying, "Hey, you maybe got that one wrong"?
I mean, from a very early age, and he attributes it to his dad and his uncle, who are both killed, assassinated, in the midst of political, his dad running for office, and he sees them as sort of up against the world, and would eventually come to see them as maybe a conspiracy going after them. And people told us that he sort of sees himself in that light, that he sees himself almost as a martyr in the same way that his dad and his uncle were, or that he wants to be. And so when the article is retracted, and when he gets all of this criticism for scientists, the people who are closest to him told us that that was just more evidence to him that he was right, that if the pushback hadn't been as strong, he might not have been as sure that it was something that he should embrace. But as the critics went after him, as the article was withdrawn, it really makes him double down on this issue of vaccines, and he ends up writing a book about it and does not move away from the issue of vaccines after he gets all of this criticism.
Where is the pivot point for him to not only supporting Donald Trump's presidency or presidential campaign, suspending his own desire to be president and signing on with the Trump campaign? What causes him to make that step? Because it was a big leap for a lot of people to watch him do.
I think that to understand his embrace of Donald Trump, you have to also understand how he moved away from the traditional Democratic Party and traditional politics. And a lot of that happened in COVID when he was able to embrace a kind of criticism of lockdowns and of the vaccine that helped to propel him into the limelight, but then also caused a reaction as social media companies closed down accounts that he had, something that he blamed on the Biden administration that was trying to counter misinformation. And so he runs for president, and he runs for president as a way of finding a platform, as a way of being heard. And his presidential campaign starts out with a bit of a boom from his name, but over the months, it's whittled away, and his campaign is in deep trouble by the time that the assassination attempt happens on Donald Trump. And in a sort of incredible moment, the two men connect on the telephone, and Trump says, "This, we could have a partnership that would be a beautiful thing." And at that moment, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. considers, should he join up with Donald Trump and join forces?
We are seeing, and I don't want to give everything away about the documentary. I really recommend people watch the full thing to see how it all ties together. But Mike, we are definitely living in the world in the addition of Make America Healthy Again that he has built alongside Make America Great Again or the MAGA movement. And there are a lot of scientists who come to you and say, we can't be part of this. We're leaving this. This is very dangerous for Americans, for children. Just how much has he overturned the public health establishment in America, and what were some people telling you the consequences of that might be very shortly in our lives?
And we talked to a lot of scientists and people who work, especially at the Center for Disease Control, who the CDC, who told us that it was very clear that Secretary Kennedy had come in with a feeling, a skepticism about vaccines, a determination to weed out what he saw as corruption at the agency, but which the scientists tell us was just the scientific method and the scientific process. And over these first months that he has been secretary, a number of people, he's fired an entire advisory committee on vaccines. He's pushed out a number of top leaders. Others have left feeling that they can't work at an agency where that isn't driven by science, but is driven by politics or by conclusions that the secretary already has. And when they talked to us, they said that they were very worried. They're very worried about the message that it sends to the individual decisions that people will make about whether or not to vaccinate their kids. They're worried about the policy implications, which of which there are thousands, or at least hundreds, on which drugs are going to be approved, on which what is going to be pushed, where is funding going to be, what kind of liability will vaccine manufacturers have? Lots of different ways. There's lots of different levers inside the agency where Secretary Kennedy can make the changes that he's talked about for years when it comes to vaccines.
What did you learn about this that has impacted you as you watch the news headlines of the day? Are you able to look at decisions he's making and say, yeah, that totally tracks with what he's doing? Tell me how you were impacted by this work that you've done to put this together.
I think one of the revelations about doing the film, and in the film we talked to people who are close to him, people who are in the vaccine skepticism movement, and scientists who are very much advocates for vaccines, close friends of his. And one of the things that's striking is almost everybody we talk to say that they do believe he believes these things. Both sides describe him as a man on a mission, as somebody who has come in and believes that they're almost on a divine mission from God to save America's children when it comes to what he sees as the risk of vaccines. And for his admirers, they see that as something that's very admirable about him, that he's incorruptible. And for his critics, it's something that they see as scary, as somebody who they see as unwilling to accept evidence that doesn't meet with what he already believes. So I think that was one of the striking things, and I think you can see that as his time plays out, is these really are things that he believes, and despite the controversy, he's willing to push ahead.
PBS Frontline's new documentary, The Rise of RFK Jr., is available now online. Find it on pbs.org/frontline, the PBS app, and Frontline's YouTube channel. You just heard our conversation with writer and producer Mike Weiser. There's more political coverage up next. Our Dakota political junkies are right after this short break. You're on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. We turn now to our trusty Dakota political junkies for a political news roundup. Jonathan Ellis is co-founder of the Dakota Scout, and Tom Dempster is a former South Dakota state senator. They joined us in SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. You know, when we talk about favorability rating and, you know, the likability of a governor or a candidate, and then the ways that, you know, someone like Dusty Johnson is, you know, putting forth policy that maybe separates him from others, and they're starting to find ways to distinguish themselves. That's a fairly nuanced conversation. But if I just open up my phone and start looking at my news apps.
Ooh, don't do that.
Yeah. If you just get depressed pretty quickly.
Yeah. Yeah, if you
what
just
are you noticing?
Yeah, yeah. If you just open up your phone and look at your news apps.
Yeah.
Or worse, if you turn on your television, almost regardless of what station that you listen to, even if you listen to all three or four of them, mm-hmm. what you're going to hear are all of these incantations that talk about anger, that talk about hatred, that talk about humiliation, that talk about resentment, that talk about fear, and that talk about a lust for dominance. You hear that over and over and over again. Mm. And in a book that I recently read by William Gladstone that for some reason I got in the mail yesterday, he talks about the importance of a democratic society, the importance of life, liberty, and the pursuit of freedom, or for you, Jonathan, for Tom Dempster, and for everybody else that's not like you. And anything that's different than that is antithetical to a democracy. And any time that you impose anger, I'm angry at you for having done something to me, as you hear every day when you turn on the television, when you hear hatred for another human being, which, by the way, doesn't go away, always persists. It does not go away. When you see our political leaders offering humiliation to people. One thing for sure, if you want a war, take away somebody's dignity. If you offer resentment and hostility, this has been done to you and we need to get back at them. If you invoke fear, you have to be afraid of these people. Once you do those things, you can do anything to them that you want. And that is profoundly anti-democratic. And, says William Gladstone, what you do about it is when you hear anger, hatred, humiliation, resentment, fear, lust for power, is you take out your garden hose. Those are all meant to inflame you and to inflame dark passions. Don't let that happen to you. Take out a garden hose and pour water on the fire and say, that is not for me. That is not for a democracy. Go away. Stop it.
What is the water in this case? More words?
The water is maybe you're contacting those individuals or you're contacting or having discussions with your friends and say that kind of talk is inconsistent with our democratic society and left unchecked will destroy our democratic society as it has done in so many other governments throughout the history of time. We cannot allow that to happen to our democracy. Just Stop it.
What about when people say, but can't you take a joke? I was just kidding. Or conversely, this is the thing that needs to be said, and I like this person because they're the ones who said it.
Right.
I'm not saying Lori would say that, but that's what you might hear around your family
table.
Lori
would never say that.
Probably not. Lori's got the public radio gene.
the answer would be, yes, I can take a joke, and that's no joke.
Jonathan, what is this bringing up with you? Because you're covering a lot of the things that people are saying, you know, you're making decisions. Do I cover this tweet? Do I cover these remarks? Do I cover the response to these remarks? And you're making decisions every day about what to put in the Dakota Scout that either amplifies or platforms that language because it's in the public interest to really talk about it, or that ignores it because it's like, no, that's not really worth our time.
I don't really have those issues. I think that by and large, local politics, because we're covering local politics by and large, is pretty, we haven't sunk to that standard. You know,
Larry Roden said the governor of Illinois should eat a salad.
Right.
He made a fat joke, right? That made headlines.
He was defending Christine Ohm, obviously. Mm-hmm.
But that would qualify as somebody who's humiliating somebody from a personal, and then people would say, oh, well, that's just...
Yeah. Well,
I don't know if he said he was joking.
Let me put it to you this way. And this is, I was thinking of this last night because I was on X, the news app, and Dan Pfeiffer, if anybody remembers Dan Pfeiffer, was retweeting Caroline Leavitt, the White House press secretary, and he said something very derogatory about her and how she's spewing all this. Now, Dan Pfeiffer was the communications guy for Tim Johnson in 2002. At the Argus Leader, they instituted a rule because of Dan Pfeiffer, because he was such a toxic person. And that rule was
internally, you're saying the Argus
Leader? An internal rule we had at the Argus Leader that we would not let campaign operatives attack their opponent, the opposing candidate. If they wanted to attack another candidate, it had to come directly from the candidate. And that was meant to instill civility. Okay,
that's remarkable.
And that was because of Dan Pfeiffer. And then that went into play. He was attacking John Thune. And then that went into play again in 2004, which of course we had that, you know, on that. And that was, you know, Dick Wadhams came in.
I remember him.
Yeah, GOP, and same thing. We held the rules were the rules that we're not going to let campaign operatives attack candidates. And again, that was for civility, because the thought would being that, you know, candidates won't want to go off the
dirty
rails.
Their hands,
that's changed. Now you have candidates who are just openly brawling, and they are attacking each other, whether it's Democrats calling Republicans fascists and Nazis, or you got Trump insulting everybody. Yeah, so that's what's changed, I think, in the time that I've covered politics since, you know, I'd say the late 90s when I started in journalism.
So how are you handling it now? What's your current rule?
Well, I mean, if a candidate's going to say something that is attacking another candidate, yeah, we would handle it. I try not to use campaign operatives to attack other candidates. That's a rule I've kind of held over since my Argus Leader
days. But if it's on the governor's or, you know, congressmen's or whomever's, the political leader's X account or on their social media,
then it's fair game.
Then it's fair game. They said it, even if they didn't write it, they said it because it's on their official account.
Yeah, then it's fair game.
How should the media, Tom, handle some of the toxicity that is coming? It would be very hard. I don't know who could argue that we're not hearing everything that you just said from our leaders, from the White House. I don't know, in the state, I would have to agree with Jonathan that in the state you don't see it as much. But certainly in national politics, you're seeing it all the time. How does the media handle it? What's your advice?
Well, the media has this constraint. And by reporting what somebody says, and then what reporting the opposite of what somebody says, and trying to find some sort of compromise, is almost never the truth. Maybe what the media could do is invoking a dark passion of hatred, John Thune said today. wonder how that would fly.
Well, that's
editorializing. I'm telling you how to think about this, and I can't do that. Yeah.
Why would that be an editorial if someone says, I hate my opponents? invoking the dark passion of hatred.
Do you hear John Thune saying, "I hate so and so"?
No, you never hear him.
He's buddies with Chuck Schumer. Yeah, it's funny that they have to. They're gym rats together. It's funny that they have to. They, you know.
So my only point is this, Jonathan, is the situation today for all of us. Anytime you turn on the news, is simply intolerable.
Yeah.
And so what? So what? Each of us as individuals, who vote, have to do, is say, no, life. I believe in life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Invoking hatred, invoking resentment, invoking hostility is anti-democratic. Turn it off. Pour water on it and say that's not for me, and talk to everybody about it, and especially vote against those people who invoke those dark passions. Yeah. That's our fundamental
holding them accountable and turning away from them.
That's right. Just turn them off.
I'm watching the Ken Burns American Revolution series now to prepare for a preview interview with them. So I have a screener.
Fun. Oh, you have fun with that.
I mean, I'm not going to lie, which we all know, but when you hear the language, Sam Adams is pretty fiery in his writing. these are people who are definitely invoking some passions among the patriots and among the crown. Right. So it's not new in America to have a very loud, very boisterous, very messy dialogue where people take some horrible shots at each other in the public sphere of the press and of print.
Which is exactly why democracy and a liberal democracy is always at threat, because invoke the dark passions, and all of a sudden, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness is not for everybody. It's just for you. That's why a democracy is constantly and always under threat. Yeah. And when you hear those dark passions invoked, one must say, that's not for me. That's anti-democratic.
Yeah. I want to go back to something that you said when we first started, Jonathan, which is the property tax and some of the big issues that we might see in the next upcoming legislative session. Is the property tax issue coming from, as I have been told, people calling their legislator and saying, hey, our property taxes are a problem, people calling the mayor's office, this is my personal story about my house? Or has it become a talking point where, because it's very popular in South Dakota to say we're going to lower taxes, we're going to do something, like how much of this is a problem in search, a solution in search of a problem, and how much of it is something that really needs to be addressed to make people's lives better?
What I hear from lawmakers who were going door to door in the last election, local in this area, and then certainly on West River in some areas, that was the number one issue that they were hearing from constituents. Now, there is some thought that with the post-COVID boom that came in real estate here, that is slacked off now, and that things will catch up. So there's some thoughts in there, and these are among local government officials, I think, who think, well, you know, I give it some time and everything will even out as it is. But in talking to lawmakers around here, a lot of them will tell you that was the number one issue.
Yeah. So that other issues, data centers, probably an issue.
Mm-hmm. Senator Casey Crabtree will be one of the prime sponsors on that legislation. We interviewed him for our podcast yesterday, and he explained it. He's obviously in the energy business, and so. He, it's an obvious choice, but he's in favor of that economic development.
In favor of what specifically? Of Dusty Johnson's plan?
Yes, okay. That plan give the tax incentives for those data centers because, as he puts it, they want to win the AI race. So,
when I first became a county commissioner, eons and eons ago. One of the things that I did is I went, I think, back to the 1920s or 1930s and read some minutes of the county commission. And I read those minutes and I said, oh, man, our problems today are just exactly like our problems were then. Dave Knutson is a good friend of mine. Dave was a majority leader when I was in the Senate for the past 4 years. He was also William Janklow's. He ran the office.
Chief of staff.
Chief of staff. And the one issue then, Harold Jarvis, California, Prop 7, was it?
Yeah, I think that
In was. Terms of property tax limitations, that was the number one issue that they had in the Janklow era.
Yeah.
That issue never goes away. And now with these super increases that we've had in property valuations, it's back again.
All right. What else is on your mind as you watch candidates separate themselves from each other within the Republican Party, especially as we position for campaigns? What are you noticing in the early days of the governor's race? Because certainly, you know, some candidates are out there pretty early.
Yeah.
Campaigning pretty hard already.
They are. Toby Doden, he's got to make up the deficit in terms of name recognition, so he's spending a ton of money. So you see him out on TV. You see him a lot of the advertising. They are out and about doing the parades and everything. I mean, they were at Hobo Day in the SDSU.
Okay.
Doing all, you know, the Republican. It was kind of, as it was explained to me, all the Republican candidates, it was a little uneasy. Like, you had, you know, they're all, because they were all there under the GOP float or whatever. And it was kind of a uneasy, but you know, they're all like, I guess Dusty Johnson's trying to position himself with that and some policy stuff. So, you know, we're still at that stage though where it's doesn't really get hot until later, until,
right.
You know, I'm anticipating that it doesn't get really hot until early next year.
Is it everybody's game just to position themselves as close to the president as they can?
Absolutely.
In South Dakota,
Republican,
you have to.
In Republican.
Yeah, you have to contort yourself in every way possible.
Because I am hearing pushback on that of people who are getting, especially from Toby Doden, flyer after flyer after flyer where he is saying the same message again and again, which is like, I am, you know, your Trump candidate. I don't know that's what it says on the flyer.
Right, yeah, but, I think it says exactly
But people
right.
are, you know, saying, hey, this is, you know, but he is saying that he is the person who is most like President Donald Trump, but you haven't told me what you're going to do. So where is the line between saying, I am the person who is as much like this president who's very popular, and then saying, I'm a person who has my own ideas? And I'm a person who can, you know, can there be daylight
tick,
between you and the president?
Tick, 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 tock. That question will be answered, the tock, when Trump endorses a candidate for South Dakota governor.
Will he endorse?
Pardon me?
Will he endorse a candidate?
I don't know. I would think that he would.
I would guess
that there are pressures to do so.
Typically, endorsements are worthless, but in this case, it would be very valuable.
Especially when you've got a Republican primary where only a very narrow part of the Republicans elect that candidate.
Do you think that matters? Whoever gets Trump's endorsement, are they just shoo-in then?
I wouldn't say
if
they're
Trump
a shoo-in, but I would say...
If Trump endorses Roden, then it's all over but the crying for Johnson?
I think it's a very valuable endorsement. And again, I don't write about endorsements usually because this one is a value to a Republican candidate.
That's our Dakota Political Junkies conversation for this week. Jonathan Ellis is co-founder of the Dakota Scout. Tom Dempster is a former South Dakota State Senator. You can find this conversation and all of our political coverage online. Find our full Dakota Political Junkies archive at sdpb.org/podcasts or on your favorite podcast platform. Up next, we'll talk about faith, crime, and punishment. Jeff Backer, senior pastor at St. Dismas of South Dakota, is after the break. You're on Listener Supported, SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Now that South Dakota has a plan for the new men's prison, we're inviting Jeff Backer back to the show. He's a senior pastor of St. Dismas of South Dakota. He brings ministry services into the current prison system, and he works directly with incarcerated South Dakotans. He joined me in SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls.
So St. Dismas Lutheran Church, which exists behind the walls of our South Dakota State Penitentiary System, we've existed for 35 years, and the idea was, of course, is providing a worship opportunity and pastoral care to those that are serving incarcerated sentences in our facilities. St. Dismas is an actual congregation of the Lutheran Church that exists there. So just like every congregation that's in the outside world, I have an inside counsel and have to deal with all of that kind of same stuff. And I don't do this alone. We actually have three pastors on staff. So, we bring the worship possibility. We bring the message of Jesus Christ behind the walls to those that are seeking it. And we've done that for 35 years. So organizationally, we also do other work like reentry work and advocacy and those kinds of things. But at the core and center of who we are is St. Dismas Lutheran Church.
Yeah. So for those who are seeking it, you must encounter many people who either had no faith background, who had a faith background and have reached some serious doubts, or who are carrying a lot of guilt and shame because of their crimes and the punishment, and they're fully aware of how they're living in the world. Help me understand the variety of people that you work with behind bars.
Yeah, I think you kind of name it well. I mean, the spectrum is from people who grew up with virtually nothing in a belief system. I'm not just going to say Christianity, but any sort of belief system, to people that are, steeped in it. And at some point, of course, in their life path, they found themselves out of sync with that belief system, if you would want to put it that way. Because we have very few belief systems, obviously, that would condone why I end up dealing with people. What I think is interesting, of course, is you have such an overlay of different belief systems, from Christianity to everything that's in the world, right?
Yeah.
So even with, our native brothers and sisters, we get some overlay because of some historical mission work that was done on reservations and in the West. So you have somebody that comes in and really is tied to their Native American spirituality, but, they had a little bit of an Episcopalian flavor to that, And so they're kind of seeking how that lays out. And so you kind of never know what you're going to get, And we're called into spaces to meet people where they are. We're not there to proselytize or convert anybody. I mean, they come seeking, and of course we can have conversation. But like I said, there's like 37 belief systems in the system, right? I mean, everything exists. So you've got people that are exploring Buddhism alongside of Christianity, alongside of Asatru. I mean, you just never know what you're going to get. What is also interesting in that is that people come with kind of like preconceived ideas of a little bit of that and what it's going to do for them being in the system. And I think that that's a big part of it.
What do you mean, what it's going to do for them?
There's people that come to worship, and I'm just going to speak for St. Dismas. We're a Lutheran church behind the walls, right? And we have people come kind of, they're dealing with kind of that guilt and shame, identity. I mean, those are big things for us that we deal with every day. But it also puts them in a different light inside the walls, as an example, within the culture of the prison, if you will. Not always for the right reasons. I mean, that's part of it. But I think people come seeking something bigger than themselves. Sometimes they come because they have somebody they want to know or they want to be friends with, and so they come because of that to be in that space. There's a variety of reasons why people come. In the big picture, I speak for my immediate lens on this. We work with about 10 to 12% of the population of our prison system. So last Friday, there was 3,855 people incarcerated in South Dakota in the state system. And we see or work with between 300 and 350 people, unique individuals every week, right? Mm-hmm. And that's just us. Yeah. And there's all kinds of other belief systems out there. But it's interesting, the reason that they come is, they may be going back or trying to kind of refocus themselves in a better part of life that they might have known, or relationships that meant something important to them. I have a lot of moms and grandmas that get credit for bringing, faith or some sort of faith essence into people's lives. I have people that are just simply curious, they don't know what it's about, right? And they come kind of seeking that aspect of it. And willing to admit, people come just to get out of the cell, just because it's a different place to be for an hour a week or whatever it is. But,
So your shirt says hope beyond bars, not hope behind bars.
Right. Well, there's two different sayings that we have. Hope beyond bars actually talks about that possibility of, we talk about prison functioning sacramentally. Okay. And this is maybe a theological comment. So sacraments, I mean, in a Christian perspective, generally are opportunities where God speaks into our lives, right? We pretty much all recognize baptism and Eucharist or communion as two of those opportunities, depending on our faith backgrounds. But there are other things that work sacramentally. This is opportunities where God gets to speak into our lives. And I often say prison is that for people, that, you know, they were living a life that was whatever it is, right? Out of control, addiction, mental health issues. I mean, there's so much that gets involved with that now, that prison actually takes away all of the distraction, all of the noise. And finally, they get to start asking those deep questions about who I am and who I am in the world. Mm-hmm. And is there a God for me type thing? I mean, what does that look like? And then how does that actually affect how I live my life, the decisions I make each and every day?
Here, in this place.
In this place, right? So it was interesting, just this morning at Bible study, I kind of got into this. I knew I was coming here, right? And I was like, okay, guys, I'm going to ask you a question, and I want you to give me that feedback just a little bit. And I said, why are you here? Why are you here this morning? Because I had a group, you know, 20, 22 guys, probably half of them had never been there before, you know, type thing. And each of them kind of had their own perspective. And one of the guys who's been around for a little while, and he's a lifer, he's been around, he's been in the system for well over 20 years. And he goes, you know, the perspective that I see is that people that can actually identify within that life of faith and what that means in their life just live life differently. They make different decisions. They associate with different people. They're kind of set apart here, if you will. And he said, I don't want to make it sound like we're better than everybody else, but it's just that you can see somebody who actually clings to a faith perspective because they just aren't found in those other spaces. He said, this is the difference. It's not what they do. It's what they don't do. And I said, that's a great comment, right? Because every day, I mean, we're dealing with all kinds of stuff.
Right.
And I think that that's an interesting...
Yeah, we're not naive.
Yeah. No. Yeah. Absolutely not. So I think the faith perspective of that makes it very interesting in that overlay. You know, and some guys come and try it for a while and then decide that it isn't for them, you know, and they'll fall away or whatever, or go to something else.
I'm curious to know, as you heard the some of the prison task force conversations in the press or from the meetings themselves, what are some of the things that you heard that you're looking to the future of a new prison and saying, okay, I expect this to show up in this way? Were there trends that you heard? Were there things that disturbed you or things that you found encouraging as people were having conversations about building a new facility specifically?
Yeah, you know, I kind of prefaced that question by saying I had nothing to do with where it's going or what it costs.
Okay.
But I do want to know what opportunities that it opens up for us, right?
Right.
That was the conversation with me is programmatically, are we going to take a step forward and is the facility again about storing humans or is it actually we're going to go into a conversation about what it means to now walk with people and give opportunities to be able to be successful in life, you know, whatever that might look like.
Mm-hmm.
And the response I would say to that question is it was all across the spectrum again. I've heard things, and I don't want to name names, but I've heard things that are horrific in a perspective of what prison should be and shouldn't be and those kinds of things. You know, things like take away their tablets, take away their jobs. It's not supposed to be good. You know, all of those kinds of things. I've heard that.
It's a punishment.
It's a punishment.
Right.
But it's a different philosophy. It's where you go to be punished instead of prison being the punishment itself, right?
Mm-hmm.
We would like to make opportunities. I mean, we've had people talking about education opportunities. Can people, you know, while they're incarcerated, not only get their GED, but seek degrees and certifications and other things? And we have lots of people in the system that would love to see things like that happen. We have vocational opportunities, right? And historically, that's ebbed and flowed, you know, in the system.
Right.
You know, years ago, we used to have more of a vocational certification process in some other areas of life, especially for men. It was, you know, construction, skills, those kinds of things. Now, you know, they're partnering with Southeast Tech for the welding program and some other things like that. There's opportunities for women. We're at least having those conversations, right,
sure,
about how those things look differently. I would say from my perspective, part of the thing that frustrates me is we're talking about when the new facilities are built and not about today.
Sure.
Because we have 3,855 sure people in the system today.
Today, yeah.
That are ripe for trying these other opportunities. What I have seen, and especially over the last several months to a year, is more openness to having conversation about doing new things. And we've had some new things come in programmatically into the prison that have been wonderful. So it's not that it isn't happening,
yeah,
but it's just happening in very, very small increments at this point. And I'm curious to see what that looks like tomorrow instead of 4 years down the road.
When is the work that you do being, you know, having access to religious services protected by the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, and when does it intersect with rehabilitation?
That's a great question. I think that there's a lot of perspective right now. So kind of understanding that the question might go that way, right? Statistically, access to religion does create a different environment possibility than facilities that don't have a strong, say, religious presence,
sure,
right? And again, I'm fully willing to admit, not for everybody, right? But at least it creates a different possibility and a different conversation of hope, right? And when hope comes into play, and that's a very, very strong and dangerous word, I get that, right? You will make decisions differently based on that, right? When you think that you have value in the world, when you think that you can leave this place and go back out and actually create a life which is giving to other people, not just to yourself, right? Mm. I think that comes, I'm going to say it comes differently, sometimes easier for people that actually begin to explore what that faith perspective looks like in their life while they're on the inside, as an example. Mm. I think, you know, there are people, and we get the benefit of working with people after they're released from incarceration. So, you know, we have the perspective of seeing, again, both sides, you know, where it fails miserably to people that go out and are incredibly successful. People that I get to know on the inside, and I'm like, oh gosh, you know, that guy's going to be back like in 6 months. He just doesn't get it. And he surprises the heck out of me,
yeah,
you know, and I run into him because these are now our neighbors and our coworkers,
right,
and all those kinds,
yeah,
of things, right? And it was something that was there that they learned while they were inside that just gave them that little bit of difference to make those decisions differently when they were, you know, triggered again on the outside, or, you know, when they ran into people that they used to hang out with, or
right,
all of those kinds of things.
Right.
So I think that that's a little bit of the perspective that, I mean, especially with the work that we do, we're trying to provide an opportunity that, again, the identity, you know, and what prison tells them that they are or aren't is not their ultimate identity. And that I often tell the people I work with, you don't value yourself enough in this world. You've let the world tell you who you are. And in that seeking, you found opportunities that of things that owned you, the things that told you who you were. And I said, until you can actually stand up and say, this is who I am and who I'm not, nothing changes. And I think that's the thing that our work really impacts. The other thing, and this is kind of going back to that whole conversation about the presence of what we do on the inside, you know, we bring a different way of interacting, you know, de-escalation through words, not through, you know, security means and those kinds of things. You know, we can walk through areas and encounter a guy that, I mean, immediately you know something's off, wrong, and all of a sudden in a very, very quick conversation, you realize this guy was contemplating suicide or, mm-hmm, you know, has something very, very huge going on in their life and those kinds of things that we get to speak into differently than anybody else,
yeah,
that's paid to deal with them, right? And that's the thing I think that is the biggest struggle right now, is finding that space within our system that doesn't compromise security, that doesn't compromise safety, that all of those things, but still allows us to have that presence that makes a difference. And it might only make a difference to one or two people a day, but it makes a huge difference.
Senior Pastor Jeff Backer with St. Dismas of South Dakota. And that's our show for today. We hope that it served you. In the Moment is produced by Ari Youngman and Ellen Kester. I'm Lori Walsh from all of us here at SDPB. Thank you for listening.